From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The migrant crisis, the refugee flow from the war zones and the poverty-killing fields of Africa is a major challenge for European government.
That was the voice of the Scottish politician, broadcaster, and author George Galloway speaking on Tuesday in Sochi, Russia, at the Valdai conference.
And it's not just a security challenge, though it is a security challenge. It's a political challenge because there's a rising tide of unhappiness amongst electors, voters, in almost all countries in Europe about the influx of new migrants and refugees. So that's a major task facing governments that don't really appear to be up to meeting that challenge.
The conference, which is sponsored by the Valdai Discussion Club, opened earlier this week. It bears the name of Lake Valdai, which is where the club's first meeting took place. Established in 2004, the Valdai Discussion Club aims to promote dialogue between Russian and international intellectual elites and deliver independent, objective, scholarly analysis of political, economic, and social developments in Russia and around the world. Galloway offered his opinion of some of those issues in his discussion with the press earlier Tuesday.
Of course, the East-West conflicts are considerable and worsening, though there's very few reasons for it. We seem to be back in the permafrost of a new Cold War, and the demand for sanctions and ostracization of all manner of people, including Russia, of course, but Iran now back on the agenda of the American presidency. These are all very important issues for Europe, not just bilateral issues between the United States and the countries it's targeting, but of course, Europe is dragged along in the wake of the United States. And in Germany, for example, this had its effect in the recent German elections, that the Germans are paying a very high price for American policy towards Russia. And the economic crisis inside the European Union is now compounded by a political crisis. In Austria, the election of a new government which is viscerally hostile to the EU, the British decision to leave the EU, the first round of the French presidential elections showing 43% for the candidates of the left and the right, both of them inimical to the EU. There are important elections coming up in Italy, which could well be won by another anti-EU force. So the existential crisis for the EU is not over yet.
Peter Lavelle is the host of RT's program Crosstalk, and he's in Sochi and spoke with us Tuesday morning about some of the things that he's seen and heard thus far. So Peter, how was Sochi and what are you doing there?
Well, number one, Sochi is amazingly beautiful right now. I'm looking right as we speak at the snow-capped mountains. It's turning very rapidly from autumn to winter. It's the Russian Alps. I mean, it's really, really beautiful. What am I doing here? It's the annual Valdai Discussion Club in which foreigners that are in academia, journalists, policymakers, important people are invited. We actually, the former president of Afghanistan, Karzai, is here, and other luminaries. It's a really interesting event, and so far, this is the second day. Today is the first full day, but there were festivities yesterday, and it's really just an exchange of ideas. It's really interesting, and I'd like to point out to our listeners is that a lot of people that come here that are invited by the presidential administration are very stern critics of Russia. So take that on board. You know, the plane tickets, the hotel, and a wonderful resort. I mean, they wine and dine you, and they're not particularly, not all of them are particularly friendly to you. That's, to me, one of the interesting caveats about this annual event.
You know, I'm looking at a quick Google of Valdai Discussion Club, and there's a Washington Post piece from last year, actually, October 26th. As I noted, if it's not obvious, this is a Vladimir Putin-approved event. I mean, they take a dig right away from the top. What are some of the things you've actually seen while you're there? Because you have all these, you know, this brain trust, our global brain trust, kind of invited into the Russian Alps. Aside from gawking at the beauty and marveling that, gee, the toilets do in fact work, despite what was on TV in the U.S. a couple of years ago. What's going on in front of you?
Well, right now, I mean, this is getting a lot of television coverage, obviously, domestically, but there are foreign television stations and correspondents here. No, this is, you know, this is a very difficult time that we live in, a standoff pitting the West against Russia, and you know me well enough, and your audience knows me well enough. It's a standoff that is generated in the West. And the Russian side, state and private and civil society, is engaging their counterparts. And I think that's very constructive. And it's also very necessary to have dialogue, particularly since official Washington and London and Brussels don't want to have open channels and an exchange of ideas. And I mean, this, I sat through a few sessions already, and there's a lot of blunt talk. And it's, you know, Don, it's really refreshing. You know, cut out the verbiage, and it's a discussion of how we got to this point and how we're going to get out of it. And there's not a lot of answers how to get out of it. I think a lot of people have differing opinions how we got here. But what's, I think there's a recognition of that we need to somehow move forward. And there's a recognition that's going to be very, very difficult.
Looking at some of the things going on around the world, of course, which we've been discussing on an ongoing basis. We have what's happening in Korea with, yesterday the deputy permanent representative said, you know, we're really toying in the real world with nuclear war. You have that going on in that part of the world. You have, HUAC 2.0 taking place in Washington pretty much on a daily basis. And the U.S. government almost paralyzed in a, you know, like a circle firing squad. Everybody is, you know, they're positioning themselves for what? I don't know. Like, who's going to have the central casket at the funeral or something? What does it look like from there?
Well, it's interesting that everything, all roads lead to Trump. You know, I think that's what a lot of people are asking. How Russia perceives Trump. Of course, the Trump's decision to decertify the Iran deals has a lot of coverage here as well, because Russia is one of the signatories of that agreement, right. And what it means, the implications of what it means for Iran, the greater Middle East, and, you know, obviously the European Union, along with France, Germany, and Britain are part of that agreement. And how, what does that mean? And there is a general recognition here, and again, it's from the Western side, that the divisions between Washington and Brussels is widening, and what are the implications of that as well? One of the things I think a lot of our listeners would really genuinely appreciate, that this is a very broad stroke event here. People are looking at very big ideas. What's happening with the world order? Is there something that's going to replace it? Are there parallel world orders coming into play? What is the role of Russia? What are the roles of the BRICS countries, the G20? It's really quite fascinating. It's kind of like being back in graduate school.
Yeah. Yeah, except there's perhaps a mushroom cloud at the end of the semester,
sure,
which is a problem. have you seen anyone speak yet, any of the luminaries?
Well, there's a lot of representatives from various countries. I mean, China is getting a lot of attention right now. It always is. I mean, that's been something that's, over the past decade, people are more and more craning their heads to asking what the Chinese position is, because I think there's a genuine and general understanding that there's with what's happening with domestic American politics, is a void is being created, irrespective of the bombast that comes from the White House. Is that there's a concern that there's no one really at the wheel in the U.S. and well, for better or worse, and I think you and I would say for the worse, a great deal of the international security architecture is anchored in Washington, and now Washington has gone AWOL, and a lot of people are wondering what to do next. And in a way, don't misunderstand me when I say that, I kind of welcome this because we're going to have to do this anyway. So why don't we get to work now? And yeah. So I think there's that kind of concern about what are the options available to the world as we move in these very stormy times, and they very much are.
You know, Russia has become more assertive as a, you know, as a global player, certainly as a regional player, in the past few years. I don't know where you could track it to 2007, standing up to protect its own territory against Georgia and NATO, or if you take it to say the refusal to allow the U.S. to do a Libya to Syria at the Security Council, or the actual assistance, military assistance given to the Syrian government. Now we're seeing a lot of things spin out as a consequence of that. One, perhaps peace on the horizon in Syria, which would be a real benefit for all of humanity, actually, as threatening as that was to global peace. And also in Iraq, some interesting consequences, as we saw with the recent battle between the Iraqi government and the Kurds, or I would say more, a realignment of the configuration of relative forces between Baghdad and the Barzanis.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Looking at it, how Russia looks at all of this, is that, you know, is one of the things that's been brought up at this conference here in Sochi. Should Russia be seen as being an assertive power? And my retort is really quite simple: is that Russia only goes where it's invited. Okay, I mean, right. We look at one blunder after another. I mean, one of the great quote-unquote achievements of the end of the Cold War is that the United States had found itself in almost an absolutely hegemonic position in the Middle East. And because of one blunder after another, the stakeholders on the ground are saying Washington cannot be trusted. They're irrational. They work against their own interests. They sacrifice allies at the drop of a hat. And now it's time for to look at other parties to come in. And all of them. We have it's the Egyptians, it's the Syrians, it's the Jordanians, it's the Iraqis, Iran. It goes on and on. And this is not because of Russia asserting itself. It's actually filling a void, a vacuum, right, because of disastrous policies coming out of the Republican and Democratic administrations in Washington.
Yeah, I mean, my personal view here, looking at Washington, and I spent the better part of the last 2 weeks there looking at it up close, is that, January 20th wasn't the beginning of American history, and the beginning of the problems that faced the United States and its relationship with the world certainly didn't begin January 20th. And in fact, a lot of what brought Trump into office in the first place can be blamed on that which happened before, the conditions that existed, say, January 19th. The role of the United States in the world as hegemon clearly is coming to an end, if it hasn't ended already. The void you're talking about filling is Russia acting as a normal player, basically. Hey, we're a big power looking at chaos in our region. We're invited in by some of the players to try to settle it and deal with terrorism. We're going to do that. Hope everybody understands what we're doing, and also come do it with us. And that's portrayed, of course, as Evil Empire 2.0.
Yeah, well, the thing is that the fundamental shift here, but it's not being widely recognized, particularly if you watch mainstream media in the United States, is that indeed American hegemony is transforming. It's far from over. But what is coming to an end, and it's discernible, is the unipolar moment. the unipolar moment, but the end of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. Right. And that has been going on for essentially a quarter of a century. That unipolar moment is coming to an end. And other people are being asked to fill that vacuum. And it's, for example, the Middle East. The Middle East's problems are going to be done by the stakeholders on the ground at the end of the day. At the end of the day, that's how it's going to be resolved. And if outside powers can come in and help mediate, and Russia talks to everybody. There's not one party in these conflicts that the Russians don't have an in with. Right. The United States cannot do that. And that's much to its detriment. Right. And so, we all have to remember that, you know, geography means everything. You know, real estate. Right. I mean, Russia has a vested interest in seeing this happen. They don't need to see waves and waves of migrants and immigrants. And of course, with the political ideologies like Wahhabism that is attached to it that comes from that region. They don't need that. They don't want it. They experienced it in Chechnya. Up front and close for 3 years.
Yep. And meanwhile, we have George Galloway there, for example, an hour or two ago, describing the current situation as a permafrost of a new Cold War. Is that the consensus there, do you think?
Well, you know, I really kind of push against describing our contemporary moment as the new Cold War, because there's something else that's going on. There's a lot of other things going on. The Cold War, of course, was about ideology, but it was about two different blocks. What's going on now is it's much more multifaceted. Yeah. We have different regional groups coming together. We have like the BRIC countries. What I would say it is, and I get a lot of pushback on it, is that it's as we have the post-World War II order crumbling, it's countries like China and it's like Brazil and Russia, India, they're looking at a world order that goes beyond the West. It doesn't mean it excludes it or it's against it.
Right.
Is it essentially, is it, you Europeans and you Americans, you know, you're playing in your postmodernist world. It has polluted your domestic politics. It's confused your foreign policy. We're just going to go on our way. Okay? We'll check in every once in a while, but we're not going to wait for you, and we're certainly not going to adopt your ideas about society domestically and internationally. It's, you know, it's kind of like for the rest of the world, the train has left the station, and, you know, it's going to be for the West to try to figure out their own problems, which I think are almost insolvable if they continue down, doubling down on these failed ideas domestically and foreign policy-wise.
It only seems normal. The EU has a population of about 500 million people, 510 million, I think it was, at the end of last year. And the United States, with 330 million or something, say throw in another 150 million for Canada and a couple of islands or whatever, it's less than a billion people. In the BRICS countries alone, you know, you've got almost half of humanity, almost 3 billion people, or maybe a little more than 3 billion people.
And so, the economic growth.
Huge. That's right. That's where the center of gravity is for economic growth right now, if you look at the GDP increases year over year from China, you know, Russia.
In international relations theory, one of the most powerful elements of change, positive change, is a demonstration effect. Well, what you have now is an anti-demonstration effect. And it's very well noted. I mean, you know, we still use the term developing countries and all that. We have to figure out a new terminology. I mean, these countries know, for example, we talked, I think, after my trip to Beijing. I mean, the Chinese know what they want. They know how to get there, and they're going to get there. They know it, okay? And there's this sense of confidence. That confidence is sadly lacking in the West. And it's noticed. People notice it. We have huge, huge new middle classes that have come into being. In the West, we see the middle classes being decimated. You know, this is, again, going back to the world beyond the West, parallel to the West, because the internal policies of the U.S. and Europe are not going to be solved very easily, if they can be solved at all. I'm very pessimistic on those counts. But the world is a big place, and it's very, very dynamic, and you have the engines of growth that are squarely outside of the sphere of the core of the Western world.
You know, it's been more than 150 years since the Golden Spike was nailed, was in Utah or wherever it went in, linking the east and west coast of the United States with a transcontinental railroad. Now you have tied up for decades, the construction of a subway line in Manhattan, for example, on the east side, discussions over building a rail link from L.A. to San Francisco, high-speed rail, etc., while China is building a rail, high-speed rail link from Beijing to Moscow, across Latin America, a canal through Nicaragua, deep water ports along the west coast of South America and in the Caribbean, etc., etc., etc. What is it exactly that allows them to get all of these things done while here in the West we, you know, sit around and talk about it if we get that far?
Yeah, well, the thing is, get rich. Make some money. I mean, forget the ideology. What was it Dao Xiaoping said when China started its real, meaningful, non-communist leap forward? It doesn't matter what color the cat is as long as it catches mice.
Right.
And I think that's a really great way of looking at it. Plus, where do the Chinese get all of this money to do that? They're getting rid of the American debt that they have, you know, they've purchased T-bills. And you know what? The smartest thing that you could do in the world is you take those T-bills and you buy assets with it.
Right.
That's the way that the Chinese are dumping the dollar. All right, it's funding the American deficit. It's funding this new wave of military expenditure. I mean, that's all going to come to an end. The Chinese know that, and they're putting the money that they assumed from the United States as in form of debt. They're spending it, and they're turning it into assets. They're buying mines. They're building bridges, railways, building factories, creating whole new markets. That's a cat that knows how to catch mice.
Theo Sommer is there as one of the.
I just saw him spoke. He just spoke. Yes.
So the quote of the day at the ValdiClub.com website is that the geopolitical relationships of the world, essentially the major powers, are undergoing convulsive change. Is that pretty much the consensus there?
Oh yeah, I mean it's not wait to see what happens next, but come up with strategies to move forward. No, the cesspool, and this is my own personal opinion. The cesspool that you find in Brussels and Washington. I mean, a lot of people are not putting a lot of effort into it. I mean, why? When there's so many other opportunities to think about and to move forward. It's again, I'll repeat myself. It's moving forward with not keeping your eye on the power centers in Brussels and in Washington. It's time to move beyond that. How to deal with Russia in Europe, their relations, it's kind of mixed here. And I see the Russian side saying, well, it's you guys that need to take the initiative. The Russian government didn't flip Ukraine in a illegal coup against the democratically elected government and president. If you go into a store and you pick up something and you break it, you buy it. You know, you own it.
Right.
And so it's basically, you know, you guys own it. Poroshenko is your guy. It's really for you to make him move on commitments that you made with him. Other than that, Russia is going to have to just continue its long game.
And I'm perusing the website. It's the top article here today, Capitalism and Inequality, 150 Years Late. Was Marx right after all? Did you sit in on that?
Well, I mean, for me, I think the this is something that Westerners don't really want to hear. But the neoliberal order is falling apart at the seams, and everyone here knows that.
Yep.
And there's no need really to focus on how to fix it. There needs to be a different way. And there's income inequality, which affects everyone here. But that's because in the West they financialize the entire global economy. And this is the greatest danger, quantitative easing. I mean, as to fix the neoliberal order. Well, you know, where I'm sitting, they got maybe it saved Wall Street. It certainly saved Wall Street. It saved the stock market, which I really, for the life of me, can't understand why the Trump administration is always talking about it. Stock market doesn't impact the average person one iota. It hasn't for 25 years.
Right.
Okay, the average person. But It's a failure of the neoliberal order, and I think that there's a greater recognition of that. And it, of course, it talks about what kind of government you should have. I just finished a panel about, you know, does democracy create prosperity? And well, for some people, the jury's still out. And I say, well, it depends. it's not a panacea. Just because you have a democratic society doesn't mean you're going to be prosperous. If you live in an authoritarian society, it doesn't mean you're going to be poor. We have to break out of these kind of Manichaean way of looking at the world. That's the old thinking.
Yeah, there's some weird things going on, too, that are sort of facial contradictions. The move by, although there's a logic to them, even on their face, the move by Russia and Saudi Arabia, for example, to at least sit down and talk. The election this past Sunday in Venezuela, where the government, despite the polls that were published by private media outlets, won a huge victory again. I mean, it's the second one in the last 2 months, really, for them. There's contradictions everywhere. India, looking at its relationship with the United States, with Russia and China, sort of, as a pivot on a tripod almost. And here in the U.S., even with the infighting in Washington, you have the elite. If Trump represents some part of the elite, then you have the elite basically going at it, at one section at another's throat, rolling in the streets with knives. And one of the topics there is de-escalatory diplomacy in an alienated world. I mean, you have chaos and contradiction everywhere, with nuclear weapons being tested and missiles being test-fired. What exactly do we do to get from here to there, and who's talking about that at Valdai?
Well, you mentioned quite a few things there. You started off by saying the Saudi-Russian relationship, well, it's extremely complicated. Yep. and for obvious reasons. First of all, it's recognized as a given that Russia is back in the Middle East as a stakeholder, as a player, and Russia sided with the Assad government in Syria, which is an anathema also obviously to the Saudis. But you at least give it to the Saudis for recognizing the reality on the ground.
Right.
The Trump administration's recent parley with Saudi Arabia is so amazingly counterproductive. I mean, it boggles the mind. But with Russia in the mix there, I mean, it's obviously about oil prices. It's all say the truth. That's obvious. The largest producer in OPEC and the largest non-OPEC producer of oil, those are the two players, Russia and Saudi Arabia.
Right.
But it seems to me that the because of the Russian position of pragmatism, the Saudis are going to be a lot more attentive, particularly when it comes to Syria. And also, the Saudis have recognized that the Russians are going to stay in their relationship with Iran, which, of course, is Saudi Arabia's greatest enemy. But they still, the Saudi king is a pretty frail man, and he made a special trip to Moscow. I don't remember the last time the Saudi king was traveling, Don. It must have been important enough for him to go.
Right.
So this is good, because instead of having these really rigid red lines, you can't do this, you can't say this, you can't work with this person, all of a sudden we see, wow, that we need to have a lot more people at the table. Maybe one member won't sit next to the other, but maybe at the distant corner there could be some representation. That's going back to the way world politics used to work,
right,
Don.
That's right.
In a multipolar world with a small number of major powers and a great number of mid-range powers and obviously small powers. But that's the way the world usually works. It has worked that way for thousands of years. You know, for our listeners to understand, we're living in a very bizarre situation where we have a hegemon that has so many doubts at home, that is divided at home, has no clear understanding how to move forward. The elites know what they want. And then you have a great deal of civil society in the United States and in Europe that reject a great deal of what the powers that be want to do and what they have done for the last 40 to 50 years. So, if anything that I can say about Valdai, it's to return to realism lower the volume a little bit, lower the rhetoric. I haven't heard any real strong rhetoric, negative or positive, one way or another. It's very moderate here, and I like that. That's how things get done.
A business-like atmosphere to do real business of humanity. Peter, thank you very much. Pleasure speaking.
My pleasure, Don. It's great to talk to you.
The same. Take care. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.